great sadness that I write this letter informing you of my anticipated retirement.
Broward School's bombshell week.
Dr. Hepburn is as solid as it gets.
4 superintendents in 3 years for the nation's 6th largest school district.
To continue the priority to move our school district to an A.
Daunting challenges, closing schools, paying debts, earning the A.
He is the superintendent now, and that he immediately takes that position.
The school board vice chair right here live.
I was doing my job, that's why you're upset at me.
The city attorney ousted. The city manager defends the furniture.
It looks bad. It looks real bad.
There was never any malfeasance here.
The city of Miami under scrutiny. Today's reporter roundtable.
Four sets of podcast. You can
do or die, and they did. The Miami Heat earns a spot in This Week in South Florida. The big news of the week and the newsmakers all live This Week in South Florida.
Good Sunday morning. Welcome. I'm Glenna Milberg. When it rains, it pours. A flood of issues and changes at Broward County Schools this week. And as it does so often, the biggest challenges include math, as in the money. But the biggest bombshell of the week was the sudden change at the top.
It is with great sadness that I write this letter informing you of my anticipated retirement.
10 months into steering a difficult ship, Peter Locata started the board meeting this week with the news he was leaving for health reasons. And of course, we are sending all good vibes for the best outcome for him. The board made one of the fastest decisions in its tenure by giving the promotion to the district's deputy, Dr. Howard Hepburn, as the new soup.
I'm so elated to continue the focus, to continue the priority, to move our school district to an A.
Goals are big for students and teachers and the whole school community, and so are the challenges. Some big ones in the headlines this week: settlement money for charter schools, state oversight, teacher raises, security. Deborah Hickson is the school board's vice chair, one of two on the board who is elected countywide and right here with us live today. Welcome, Ms. Hickson.
Good morning.
We're on first name basis, right?
Yes, okay. Yes, for sure.
Great to have you here.
Thank you.
On what a week for you. You're a very calm, zen kind of presence here, but I know that had to be like a real tumult in the week. Take us back. I want to start with this kind of bombshell Tuesday morning. Was there any sign, had you had any kind of discussions or inklings that there was about to be a step down for Dr. Locata? And then take us through what was really a fast decision for the new superintendent.
Yes, good morning, and thank you so much for having me today. As Dr. Locata mentioned, in December, he had let all of the board members know that he was having some health issues and he was going through treatment, so I was aware of that, and I do sit next to him and, you know, notice some of the things. He was shivering a lot. There were different signs that maybe this wasn't going as well as has hoped. So, you know, I was concerned for him, but clearly very, very shocked when that happened. Sad for us as a district, because we were moving in the right direction. We had a good leader. I think our student scores are going to be very good this year. And we're repurposing and designing Broward County Public Schools, and all of a sudden, in the middle of this great movement forward, all of a sudden, you're like, oh no, we have to stop.
And if anybody who follows the news in South Florida knows, it's really been a rocky couple of years for the school district, grand jury investigation, arrests, and so this can't be a great time. But take us through, I mean, not a year ago, the district went through a national search for a new superintendent,
yes.
And then bam, inside a couple of hours, you've got a new one, and Dr. Howard Hepburn elevates right from deputy. And so that was a pretty quick decision, but not unanimous.
It wasn't. I mean, it was 8-1, so it was pretty close to unanimous. And, you know, as I mentioned, thinking about just sitting there as a board member and thinking we're right in the middle of this big movement forward. And I do know for a fact that Dr. Hepburn and Dr. Locata made a lot of these decisions together. He was the deputy superintendent of teaching and learning, but they really came into this together through a partnership. And it made sense when the motion came forward to make Dr. Hepburn, the new superintendent, especially since we know he's applying and had a good chance of becoming a superintendent in a different district. So I think that was really the big difference in why it made sense as that motion was being said, to like, yes, because we do, as we heard from public speakers during that meeting, we want stability. We want stability. And I personally just felt that Dr. Hepburn was going to bring that stability because he knows the vision. He's been immersed in all of the decisions for that vision, and it was really important to stay the course.
So you got stability, you saved a boatload of money on any kind of national search, and you carry forward. And I do want to talk about money because this week the education commissioner was in town, Manny Diaz, who was here for a variety of reasons. We spoke to him about the Board of Education in Tallahassee signing off on the settlement that Broward County Schools now has to pay because of, I don't want to say withholding, but not paying charter schools a portion of the voter-approved tax monies for teacher raises and for security. I know the district didn't have to in 2018 when that went through, but they do now. And I really, I'm not sure publicly we were very clear on the process of what was the holdup, why a settlement, why didn't the district go ahead and pay what was owed to charter schools?
So it's kind of complicated. In 2018, when the referendum went, Broward County Public Schools did include charter schools for the safety and security part. We were the only district that did that, as opposed to Dade County and Palm Beach County. So when those lawsuits came through, you know, we were kind of a little bit different than they were because they did not include them. But voters voted on a referendum that said the money would go to the district public. It's hard to say it the right way.
Schools,
right, it said the district teachers and mental health, but it would include the charter schools and the safety and security piece. So voters voted on that, and it went through, and no one really brought a lawsuit, and charter schools didn't bring up, hey, how come we weren't included in all of it, until later on. And as you know, Palm Beach County in 2019 had a lawsuit that came, and through that process, then it was determined by the courts after a couple of appeals. It wasn't even decided in the very beginning. There were two courts that said, no, charter school, that's not what the voters voted on. But then the last one did include the charter schools. So Palm Beach had to pay, and then Dade County was in the process because the charter schools had sued them. We were just starting that process. We were just recently sued by charter schools.
So let me to fast forward. This settlement is, I guess on face value, $80 million, but paid out over, and the plan is 3 years. Mm-hmm. There is no final amount, I think, that I've seen yet. This could be a real, I don't want to characterize it. Is this a budget buster for the district?
Obviously it is, and it won't be final until the charter schools. We voted on it. Now the charter schools have to, so that's why you haven't seen an actual dollar amount as of yet. And there are things that they have to do to be able to collect that money. It's just not a carte blanche.
And this might or may not affect the teacher raises that were decided upon. I know one of your colleagues, Tori Alston, on the board on Tuesday really raised questions. Can the district afford the teacher raises, little under 4%, that were promised already?
Right. So remember, 1.7% of that comes from the state. Mm-hmm. So that is not money through the district. And the other around 2% comes from our budget. What we have negotiated with the charter schools will 100% not affect teacher raises. That was voted on in the contract. The concern now is for the additional employees that we have, what is that gonna look like? And so that's a conversation that we'll continue to have. But the settlement and the way that they arranged payments will 100% not affect the teacher contract.
And one more thing before I let you go. Peter Licata was on this program when he was first took the chair. We talked about the mandate to downsize the district. A lot of the community really has concerns about their own community school, which is going to be closed or repurposed. Tuesday, it didn't look like there was much movement to report. I know they're studying it, but the broadcast version, bottom line version is there anything to report on that?
No, not really. I mean, they're going to go into those zones where they know that the schools are going to be affected. And so they're going to work with the community to be able to have a conversation on what does that look like, what schools might be closed, maybe they're changing to a K-8. One of the things that I've been really advocating for is let's try a district charter school. They do it in other districts, and you know, people seem to be navigating towards charter schools, so why not dip our toe into what that looks like? So
that's kind of novel. I think we're making, I feel my producer is making notes about something to follow up on.
Yeah, and you know, I mean, I think it's important to just try that. But there'll be different things. The idea that we're closing 30 schools, I think, is not what's going to be happening. I think most of them will be repurposed, whether through programming or changing from K to 8 or things of that nature. But there will be some schools that just have to be closed.
Yeah, sometimes it's a tough change, but we'll follow it. Debbie Hickson, thanks so much for coming in on your Sunday morning. Oh, appreciate
thanks
it.
Thanks for inviting me.
For sure.
Thank you.
All right, covering Miami city government is like drinking from the fire hose while the fires are still burning. And you're going to hear from those who do, all about the city's big changes this week. The reporter roundtable is coming up, but first, it's going to be a dogfight. We're going live to Boston next because that's where the Heat are about to take center court.
And I will mention here inside the TD Garden, it's like we never left. For the fourth time in five seasons, it is the Heat, the Celtics in the playoffs. This time, though, in the first round, we look back at the Heat shocker last year against Boston. It would be shocking today to get a win. The Celtics, a big favorite. We've got a preview of the game you can watch right here on Local 10 coming your way next right here this week in South Florida.
Is do or die the Miami Heat do? The team launches their first playoff game in less than an hour from now. The underdog against the number one Celtics in Boston, and you can see it right here on Local 10. So yes, we have a sports segment today, and yes, we have sports director Will Manso live in Boston. Will, wow, that stadium is going to be packed in just a little while.
Yeah, it's like we never left, Glenna. I think Heat fans remember it. May 29th of last year, it was right here inside the TD Garden. The Heat shocking the Celtics in Game 7 of the Eastern Conference Finals, advancing to the NBA Finals, beating one of the best teams in the NBA as an 8th seed. They'll have to do it again, though the circumstance is a little different. We take you back to that moment. It was incredible. The silenced crowd here in Boston that was expecting to celebrate instead, watching the Heat celebrate. But today, it is going to be tough. You are talking about a Celtics team that had a historically great season, one of the best regular seasons in NBA history. The Heat, meanwhile, that scratch and claw themselves just to get into these playoffs by beating the Bulls in the play-in game the other night. And today they play again without Jimmy Butler, their injured superstar, who is out for the foreseeable future. Boston, a 14-point favorite for Game 1, an overwhelming favorite for the series. So how do the Heat approach the series? They approach it with the confidence that they can shock the world.
It's gonna be a dogfight. It's gonna be a battle. It's gonna be in the mud. It's not gonna be pretty basketball. And that's usually how it's been when we see that team.
I feel like we're better when our backs are against the wall anyway. So we're gonna, you know, go to Boston tomorrow and come up with a game plan with the coaching staff to stop one of the better teams pretty much ever, really, on paper.
So can the Heat get it done? Not just in this series, but today's Game 1. Only one place to find out back home in South Florida, right here on Local 10. Coverage begins at 1 o'clock as the Heat, again, 14-point underdogs to this Boston team that was dominant in the regular season, dominant here on their home court. But the Heat have history on their side the way they've played Boston the last few years. Four time in 5 years they meet in the playoffs. First time, though, it happens in the first round. And Glenn, as I throw it back to you back home in South Florida, I want you to remember one thing for fans as you watch this game. Ugly is pretty. For the Heat to have a chance in this series of today, they have to keep it ugly. They have to keep it slow. If they let the Boston Celtics play to their pace, this could get ugly in the wrong way for Miami.
You know, though, they love that underdog thing.
They relish it. They live for it. Tyler Herro said, bring it on. This is where we like to be. They don't mind. Though you wish you did it in a different circumstance for Miami. They've proven it before. They can get it done, and they're confident as well. Despite all the overwhelming odds, they can get it done today.
Will Manso, soon to be a regular on This Week in South Florida. Have fun. Thanks so much.
Sign me up.
So anyone who thinks government meetings are boring have probably never been to a City of Miami Commission meeting where the spectacle is usually for all the wrong reasons. A sample from the last one.
I was doing my job, that's why you're upset at me.
No, I'm not upset at you because of that. No, I think you've been doing a bad job and advising ill, because every time we ask you a question, I don't trust you.
From the ousting of the city attorney to the still confusing math about office furniture from the manager's wife's family's company, to a judge throwing out the new district lines that appear to have been maneuvered into place to benefit incumbents, Miami once again takes up the oxygen in the newsroom. We bring it all to the reporter roundtable to some of the people whose beat it is to cover and uncover City Hall doings. Joey Fletches is now associate editor at the Miami Herald, fresh from being the Miami beat reporter. That's only a week old. Congrats to you. Billy Corbin is a filmmaker, his company Raconteur, and at the same time a prolific chronicler of Miami dysfunction on blast. Josh Ceballos is a government accountability reporter with WLRN, who's reporting open the scrutiny into the no-bid taxpayer-funded business Miami was doing with the manager's in-laws. Sarah Blasky is the investigative reporter with the Miami Herald, who chronicled with Joey events that headlined Miami Shakedown City. Wow, I have just a very auspicious group here today, and I really value you coming in, of all veterans of This Week in South Florida, and what a week at Miami. And I really do want to start with the ouster of Victoria Mendez. And, you know, technically, Billy, you're not a reporter, but you are in this case, because your reporting has really had an effect on this community. And since Victoria Mendez has called you names in public, I will give you the first, you know, she says she was called insubordinate and feels like that just was not the case and should not have been fired. What do you think?
Well, that is very much the case, and she should have been fired. I think if you understand one fundamental fact about the city of Miami, everything else starts to make sense, and that is the city is a criminal racketeering organization masquerading as a government, and it runs like any mafia does on fear.
You can say things that the reporters at this table cannot say.
Well, I think it's demonstrable. I mean, you need to only watch one city commission meeting and discover how dysfunctional and corrupt this place really is. And it runs on fear and intimidation, and I would say extortion. And if you work in the city and you swear that omerta, you get rewarded and you get promoted. If you don't, you get forced out. And the same is true of residents and business owners. They will target you, retaliate against you, take your home and your business if they have to. It is a third world banana republic, tin pot dictatorship.
Okay, well, with that open, I want to open it up to the reporters at the round table. I mean, you all at the Herald have really covered a lot of the facts and evidence and court cases around, you know, the nitty gritty of what Billy just kind of headlined. Sarah, I want to just kind of stay with the week's events because the show's only an hour long. The ouster of Vicky Mendez really did sort of start to percolate up with the lawsuit that was brought against Joe Carollo by the Little Havana businessmen, that they got a jury verdict on their side.
Right, a $63.5 million jury verdict
so
on their side.
What did she have to do with that?
So Vicky Mendez, I think, sort of macro level, right, Glenna, is a person who's kind of got a hand in a lot of pots in the city of Miami, to say it that way. And so what she has done is she has kind of gone out and not just done what a city attorney often does, which is, you know, protect the interest of the city, make sure that the commissioners on the commission do their jobs within the rules of order, within the rules that are set out for a commission. She's also commented on that case. She's been sort of proactive in that case in defending, or at least verbally defending, Commissioner Carollo.
But is that not, is that
she's
not
a mob lawyer.
That would not be normal.
Well, you know, I think a lot of people who approach City Hall and approach a city attorney are looking for interpretations of the city code. They're looking for interpretations of the city charter, what's correct, what's not. Not necessarily an automatic defense of a commissioner who is being, you know, dragged into court and accused of violating the Constitution, right? And a lot of the statements that, you know, Sarah's referring to, that you're talking about, Billy, are statements where she came out and she attacked these Little Havana businessmen mm-hmm. and besmirched their reputation as a means of justifying the taxpayers paying for the legal defense of Joe Carrozza.
And for context, though, she is defending one of her clients on the City Commission to the detriment and even against some of her other clients on the City Commission, and that is the insubordination and the unethical misconduct we're talking about.
Josh has the great deal of sitting next to Billy and trying to, I know so much I'd like to say.
And that beautiful shirt.
Oh, thank you. Well, I mean, I would just also say, I mean, although she was not named in the initial lawsuit from Bill Fuller and Martin Pinilla, there are certain details in there that mention her. Like, for instance, she was allegedly the go-between between Carollo and former city manager Emilio Gonzalez. And he testified in court. Gonzalez testified that she said that he needed to pasar la mano or calm down Joe Carollo by going after some of Bill Fuller and Martin Pinilla's properties with code enforcement. So she's named, she's embroiled in that whole mess.
You know, this is the city, I think we mentioned it last time, this is the city where when they ousted the police chief and brought in a new one in the back room, they played, somebody put on the
Godfather. Joe Carollo played the Godfather theme
on his cell phone. Godfather
on his And she has been the mob lawyer. She has been the Tom Hagen that has enabled this corrupt behavior. And she's had a blank check to spend tens of millions of dollars of taxpayer money to defend this corruption. I think Josh brings up an important point. That $63.5 million corruption judgment, the jury said unequivocally, Joe Carrollo did not act alone. He weaponized city government to violate the constitutional rights of these business owners. It implicated the city manager, it implicated the city attorney, code, building, zoning, the police chief, and nothing has really been done about that. There's been no independent investigation. Nobody at the city wanted to talk about it until, fortunately, Commissioners Pardo and Gabello arrived.
So I was just going to say, it seems like we've been talking about this, the news has been reporting it. Do we have the sound from Vicky Mendez defending herself at the commission? I feel compelled to say that Joe Carrollo is appealing the lawsuit and Vicky Mendez says she didn't do it. I think that's very fair to bring that out because they're not here. But they're, do we have that sound by chance? Let's take a listen to Vicky Mendez at the last, when this all went down at the last meeting.
So I'm in the hot seat because unfortunately, though you say that these matters aren't personal, you're upset at me for doing my job.
No, when I was upset at you because you interfered in an election.
You're upset at me for doing my job pursuant to the charter, which was to make sure that I followed the charter.
You're hid behind
the charter.
That
is why, so it is.
We're in the United States of America. We're in the United States of America. And you guys know full well, when I came here, if you didn't know, now you know it on June 14th at my house, I'm a candidate, and this is all documented. And then you know what you did? You filed a lawsuit with the city's money, with the taxpayer
pursuant
money
to
against
the charter.
And then I won that lawsuit. I won that lawsuit, and then you doubled down again for a second time, and then you
pursuant
doubled down
to
for
the
a third.
Charter.
Pursuant, and then you know what you did? Now you got us into a position of interpretation of what the charter is. Actually, do you have to live the year prior, or can you live any year prior to that? You got us
pursuant
into that position.
Pursuant to the charter. So I was only doing my job, whether you were a candidate or not. I was doing my job. That's why you're upset at me.
Okay, just for context, that was not obviously Vicky Mendez defending herself, which she did for a while. This is about the case of this new commissioner, Gabella, which we'll talk about too in the redistricting that had him redistricted out of the district he was running for. But we're going to talk about that. But I really want to stay with Vicky Mendez just for a moment. It seemed like whatever was in the headlines and whatever we've been talking about, those two newly elected commissioners were the game changer in a practical sense.
They were. They elected in November. Their platform was very clear that there needed to be change in the city of Miami, and that largely they were saying it began with the city attorney's office and the city attorney's actions. It also extends to their disagreements with Commissioners Joe Carrollo, former Commissioner Alex Diaz-Portilla, who Gabella beat after he was removed from office because he was arrested on corruption charges, those trials pending. So, you know, obviously the atmosphere
already,
was...
We already talked about this.
There are also a bunch of lawsuits. The city of Miami is facing a number of lawsuits. And recently, as you mentioned, the redistricting suit. And so what happened this past week was that one of those commissioners, Commissioner Pardo, came and said, basically, we've lost faith in your ability to give us sound legal advice. And I think that that was the basis of her removal, which was effective immediately. She is still employed by the city for the next couple of months, but she is no longer the city attorney. and that was because of all of this, not just the Carollo case, not just the redistricting case, but yes, because of Gabella's, you know, does he live in the district he was running in? Does he not? That was a question that we talked about a lot last year. Yes.
And I think it's important to note that, like, all of these lawsuits, the taxpayers are paying for them. All of these lawsuits that the city is being sued or going after people, and when they lose, the taxpayer has to pay those attorney's fees. Like for the redistricting case, which I know we'll talk about, they paid an outside law firm over $1 million to represent them.
So do you think now that there will be a change in the city attorney's office, do you think there will be a change in a practical sense?
Well, change is slow and it's incremental, but it's starting to happen. I think that's apparent.
So you're confident that whoever is in that office now will do things differently?
Confident? I think I'll give them enough rope to hang themselves with, but I think we're going to have to give whoever it is a chance, an opportunity to do better. Right now, it's looking like it's going to be an internal promotion, which I'll be candid, is disturbing. If you've been a part of the problem for so long, how are you suddenly going to be a part of the solution? But we shall see.
Okay. You won't be surprised to know we have so much more to talk about, but a quick break and we will be right back. We are back with the Reporter Roundtable on Miami, I guess what my grandmother used to call Michigas, Miami Michigas. Josh Ceballos, you broke the story of the furniture company belonging to the city manager's in-laws that had a very lucrative business with the city. Not saying right or wrong, but certainly not as transparent, we learn, as it probably should have been. And this week, with that memo, they cut ties. But to get to cutting ties, the city manager was reporting or issued reports in his own little audits that really never rose to complete.
Right, that's correct.
So, I guess that's the shortest way I can.
Yeah, that's it. It's trust me, when I write my radio scripts, it's so hard getting into all of it. But yeah, so in January, my reporting partner Danny Rivero and I reported on Pradere Manufacturing, which is owned by the
Pradere,
but I mean that's their last name. So yeah. Art Noriega, the city manager, his wife is Michelle Pradere Noriega, and her family owns this furniture company. And they've been doing business with the city for decades, even before Art was city manager, even before they even got married. But it continued after he became the head of the city. And they also started selling furniture to the city manager's office once he was city manager. So we reported on that. And after that, he said, oh, at the next meeting. So
a no-bid contract, I think, is really relevant.
To be clear, I mean, it's under a state contract and under a city resolution, they're allowed to buy from vendors off of the state contract that have been competitively solicited. But there was no like public bid within the city because they can get through that with all of these resolutions and stuff.
There was also no individual bidding on the individual jobs.
It just automatically. It was just like automatically to yeah, that's correct. So he said he would come out with this report. It came out a little late, like over a month later. But it was incomplete. I mean, the report said that the city had only spent a little over like $200,000 with Pradere. But our numbers from city records that we requested showed like $440,000 just between 2020 and 2023.
And he's actually, before he was city manager, was the parking director.
He was the parking director.
He's been with the city way before that.
Right. He's been in city leadership for a long time.
Since 2000.
Okay.
In that period, he has spent, as that leader of the Miami Parking Authority and a city manager, over $2 million at Pradere Furniture in total, based on the public records I've obtained from the city.
Can we just air what the city manager said at the meeting this week?
Sure.
I've been in public service for well over 27 years now, through two iterations at the Parking Authority and as my tenure as city manager. Never, ever taken a penny outside of my salary as it relates to my job. Never had outside employment, never done consulting work. What I've earned the hard way, right? And I've never taken that for granted. No one's ever questioned my ethics before relative to compensation and the job.
True.
Well, if you were to accept that the city manager's wife's company, a company that she works for and her family owns, benefiting from city contracts doesn't ever reach him, then I suppose you could believe that. But, I mean, one of the things that even commissioners made clear in the conversation, you can't steer around it, is that it looks bad. That's a quote that
I think that was Manolo Reyes. Right. Yeah. Like, it looks bad.
And others have said variations that it smells bad. How is this defensible?
Yeah.
So and it got so much that, yes, even he had to admit, because he knows how to count votes, right, that this is going to be something that stops. The whole city cannot do business
but
with this company.
He initially said, my office will stop doing business with Planet. We won't be buying from them for my office. But then Manolo Reyes said, I don't think the city should be doing business with them.
For the reasons that I think you were outlining.
By the way, I think he uses the term public service very liberally there. When you consider that he is the highest paid employee at the city, his compensation package, I think at this point, exceeds $400,000 in one of the poorest cities in the country, where the median household income is about $47,000. So this man has been enriched, and perhaps he's earned it at the public trough. But this side hustle, this kind of grift that everybody at the city has, the mayor has at least two or three dozen side hustles and outside grifts. The city attorney that you've talked about, she and her husband allegedly prey on sick elderly homeowners to force them out of their homes and flip them.
Okay, you're at the table making allegations that have been made in the public. Sarah, you covered the city attorney's husband's business, and what did you find?
Well, so what we know is there is a lawsuit, and I have to give credit to WLRN here, because they are the ones that actually broke the story about the...
Do you feel like we're a team sometimes?
Oh, yeah, 100%. Like, if not for these guys, like, I would not be able to sleep at night.
Well, we're actually news partners as well.
Yeah, WLRN
and Miami here. No.
But please continue. Yeah, go.
So, you know, basically, the idea is that the city attorney's husband has a company that flips homes, and the allegation is that through her work at the city, she had information that helped, you know, guide her husband's business towards homes that, you know, could be flipped for a profit. Often these were homes through the guardianship program. Josh, obviously jump in because you know this program better than I do, but basically homes that belong to elderly people or people that were incapacitated for one reason or another. And so, you know, there is a lawsuit that Victoria Mendez and her husband are facing right now about this house flipping business. There's also a bar complaint into how she has engaged with that business as the city attorney. She's actually facing two ongoing bar complaints. Right. The other one I think we should mention here was brought by Billy Corbin for something that she said to him from the dais. She called you a vile little man.
I believe it's now on a t-shirt. So just for the record and for purposes of fairness, it is an allegation that they deny. And we will leave it right there. We have one more segment of this coming up, and I do want to go back to the redistricting, which is the word that makes people's eyes glaze over. But what happened in Miami with that kind of apparent shell game is very interesting, and that is where we will start when we come right back. All right, just to bring you up to speed for the break, we're talking about tips. And when Billy has a tip, feel free just to share it with your friends. Yeah.
Oh, I do.
Okay. All right, so I really, I want to talk about this whole redistricting bombshell from a judge, because the redistricted maps, which was used for an election that just passed with two new commissioners, is now invalidated. Who covered this the most?
I'll jump in. Yeah, so like these advocacy groups, a lot of them from Coconut Grove, but from every part of the city, sued the city in December of 2022, saying that the most recent redistricting was racially gerrymandered. That means according to the judge, yes, it was. The judge officially said that all five districts in the city are racially gerrymandered. That means that they were cut up based on race. The commissioner said it from the dais. They wanted one black district, one white district, and three Hispanic districts. And they were very clear that that's how they wanted it built up. But that's illegal. That violates the 14th Amendment of the Constitution.
Are you comfortable, or do you know, calling out which commissioners said that?
Yeah, I mean, that was all of them.
It was a pretty what? And the city attorney did nothing to intervene and say, guys, this is not constitutional.
But there's a reason for that, and that's because that's how it's been since the city has had districts since 1997.
By design or default?
By design.
Yes. Unconstitutional by design.
It's remarkable that what drove home the judgment. What really the judge hung on to, he even said it in court this year, was the commissioner's statements themselves delivering exactly what the ACLU and Deckert and the advocacy groups were asking for, which is this admission They wanted to pack districts a certain way, to get certain ethnicity or race represented at certain seats in the city of Miami.
And there's a reason why that's wrong. Like, it sounds like a good thing, like, oh, they...
Well, you think?
Right. But the reason that the city gives is because, oh, we want to make sure that there's always black representation on the dais. But when you say this is the only... District 5 is the only black district, that means black people in Miami only have power if they live in District 5. Yeah, sure. And so that dilutes their power.
So their argument was kind of bastardizing the Voting Rights Act, which protects black voting districts.
And the judge cited direct quotes from nearly the entire commission from 6 separate meetings over 2 years. I mean, the evidence was all handed to him by the city commission itself. And you have to remember this somehow gets worse because the perversion of the redistricting process is part of what I refer to as this criminal enterprise that operates in the city.
Come on, it's a news program.
My attorney, the alleged criminal enterprise that is. I'm not specifying any particular crimes, but now we are. Judges found this to be unconstitutional. And what they did here, in addition to the racial gerrymandering, is individual commissioners, both defendant Joe Carollo and now under arrest commissioner Diaz de la Portilla, they actually manipulated the process in order, in the case of Joe Carollo, to move his home into the historic grove and divide up a community that is older than the city's incorporation itself. And in the case of Diaz de la Portilla, try to gerrymander out his opponent
What
this perversion of the redistricting is far more corrupt than even the judge decided.
And just so everybody is aware, I mean, especially in the case of Commissioner Carollo, it is, if you look at the map, you have to zoom in on this tiny, tiny little carve out around the part where his home is. It's really remarkable, and I encourage the audience to look themselves. It's hard to imagine why it would be drawn that way.
Yeah. Yeah, when you have the organic border of US-1 forever.
Exactly. Right.
Well, if you can imagine that, the in the case of District 1 with Diaz de la Portilla, that map that drew Gabela out was after a judge had told them to go try again. That came last summer.
They tried again and came up with the same.
They carved out the candidate. They gerrymandered it again. Yeah, so basically the judge last week says both attempts were wrong. So you have to go back.
And he said, in the judge's order, he said, the city will no longer be allowed to use these maps at all, and has basically said, we're going to order you to take new maps, and likely from the ACLU.
He also found they cannot hold elections.
And they can't hold elections.
Be responsible under these unconstitutional districts.
But the last elections were held under this.
Correct.
So the implications of this are completely
mystery. That was going to be my next question.
Is everyone unelected now? We have no idea.
I'm leaving. You could just ask the questions.
The judge said that the court could order special elections because if every district is racially gerrymandered, that means everyone on the dais is inappropriately on the dais.
Who are
currently on the commission, the newly electeds and even the previously electeds, because it's always been racially gerrymandered. So there could be special elections in all the districts, but we have to see how that shakes out with the settlement.
So the mayor is the only one that isn't in a district. Right. So the mayor would be the ceremonial mayor who doesn't have a vote on the commission would be the only member that wouldn't be caught up on that.
What we do know now is that there have been active settlement discussions since February when it looked like, when the judge basically said, like, this is looking good for the city. So, and what we understand is that in the next couple of weeks, there's probably going to be some sort of settlement discussed at a commission meeting, and it could involve a different map, some kind of election schedule, all the things that the judge mentioned in his order. So stay tuned in the next couple weeks.
What the judge does in this order is he spends 80 pages lighting the whole city on fire, and then on the last page goes, and in some future date, we'll have a conversation about, will we call the fire department? Will we rebuild it from scratch? We'll just have a hearing on that at some other time.
Right.
But what happens right now? I mean, the decision's being made right now at the city.
Are any of them legal? Are any of them constitutional? Can everybody who has had business before...
Maybe Vicky Mendez has her job back because that decision is made by commissioners who were elected from gerrymandered districts.
Well, everybody who's had business before the city commission, can they conceivably come back later and say none of this was legal or constitutional? I want a rehearing of every single issue that has come before this board. Who knows?
You're making faces.
That would be interesting, and like that would certainly make for a lot of work. But definitely, I mean, there's like Joey was saying, there's settlement discussions going on right now. Right now, that's behind the scenes.
With whom?
That's the plaintiffs, the advocacy groups, and the ACLU of Florida, which is their attorneys, and then the city's legal department and the commission. So those are private meetings that are not in the sunshine, so reporters can't be there for those meetings. But they're doing the wheeling and dealing, trying to come up with a settlement, and eventually that will become public, and we'll see what ends up happening.
I want to, in the last minute or so that we have here, Sarah, we have taken a lot of time this hour talking about Miami government.
our audience is from Boca to Key West. And for those viewers who don't live in Miami and maybe are just kind of fascinated from afar, I kind of bring home the implications for every city government, every county government, every South Floridian watching what's happening here. Is there, or is this kind of its own unicorn?
You know, that's a great question. I would love to say that I think it's unique, but I don't think so. I've covered various governments across South Florida over my time at the Herald, and we do see corruption pop up. We do see these allegations pop up. The city of Miami also, I think, thinks of itself as a leader in South Florida as a government, right? They're the example. Mayor Suarez would like you to think that, you know, he has this big influence in South Florida. He does to some extent. And as the leader, I think whatever happens in the city of Miami government is something that will influence the way other government officials act in their governments as well. And so I think that's how it becomes relevant to everyone else.
And a fodder for documentaries that a Miami filmmaker might want to do in the future.
Would you like to buy my Miami coin? Because I'm selling all of it.
I'll pass. Thank you very much. Josh Ceballos from LRN, Billy Corbin, raconteur, filmmaker. What's your name again? Joey Fletcher, newly minted associate editor at the Herald, Sarah Blasky, investigative editor. You all veteran roundtablers, and I so appreciate your insights and your intellect and your time, and thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And you'll be back. Who are you, someone's boss now? You her boss?
Thank God. Just, I'm not.
All right, when we come back. Florida, as you know, loses a legend, and the outpouring in the week ahead for former Governor and Senator Bob Graham. Finally today, remembering the best kind of Florida man, former U.S. Senator and former Governor Bob Graham, who passed away Tuesday at 87. This procession bringing him from Gainesville to Tallahassee. The whole state will have a chance to pay respects there next week. From the Miami Lakes city his family helped found, Graham leaves a legacy of public service that few in Florida history can match. A leading force for the environment, for education, transportation. A giant of a man who was every man, and showed that by the hundreds of work days he did to walk in the shoes of everyday Floridians. So dedicated to public service, Graham founded a center for it at the University of Florida to carry that forward. Graham will lie in state for 2 hours next Saturday at the historic Capitol in Tallahassee. That's actually now a museum on the grounds of the current Capitol. A military honor guard will accompany his casket to the site. The public is invited to pay respects from 11 to 1. And then after, his family will have a private burial at a cemetery near the governor's mansion where Graham lived and served for his 8 years as governor. We will be in Tallahassee to bring that home to you on Saturday, and then Sunday we'll bring you This Week in South Florida live on the road from Tallahassee. So we're looking forward to that. We'll be right back. Connect so easily with us on social media, via email, and we hope you do. Thank you so much for being with us, and have a beautiful Sunday.